Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I would like to be saying welcome to the Bodleian Library, but we're in the Maths Institute, so I encourage you to use your imagination and imagine ourselves in a few hundred yards to the east of us here at the moment. My name is Richard Ovend and I'm Bodleian Librarian. I'm the 25th person to hold the title, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all this afternoon. The format of this session is going to start off with me giving you a brief update on what the Bodleian is doing at the moment and the kinds of work that we've been engaged with over the last few years and will be in the future. And then Professor Sir Dermot McCulloch and I are going to have a conversation about the role of libraries, the role of the Bodleian in this digital and analog hybrid age that we live in. So, and then there'll be some time for you to ask us some questions at the end. So I think I will begin. And we of course start with our founder, Sir Thomas Bodley, who 414 years ago established the institution that I have the honour and privilege of leading at the moment. And Sir Thomas Bodley had three key mission statements. One was about the preservation of collections, another was about opening up the institution and the collections that he established for what he called the whole Republic of the Learned, and thirdly to ensure the sustainability of the of his institution, and through endowing the key members of staff and the role of the library as a collecting institution. And of course that's left a legacy behind of an extraordinary inheritance of research materials. And of course many of you will have walked through Duke Humphrey's library in the historic parts of the Bodleian and seen the great accumulation of printed and manuscript treasures that still rest on the shelves there. And some of you will be familiar with some of our kind of high spot items, like the first complete book written in the English language, King Alfred's translation of Gregory the Great's the Regula Pastoralis, one of the New Year's gifts written by the young Princess Elizabeth to her stepbrother Edward VI, Mendelssohn, a presentation copy of one of his Lieder with his own illustration in the corner. Many people know Mendelssohn, of course, as a master composer, but few will recognise his talents as a visual artist. Our collections are not just confined to Western Europe or to these islands, but have been accumulated from all parts of the globe. We have the greatest Sanskrit collection outside of South Asia, for example. This is a birch bark manuscript from the 12th century. And then more recent acquisitions include some of the things you might not expect to find in a great research library, like advertising literature, ephemera, posters. This is a poster for a textile company in Scotland. I sometimes think of it as a kind of metaphor for Bodley's librarian or the vice-chancellor, hemmed down by bureaucracy or whatever you like. And of course, our collections have been established through 400 years of what we now call legal deposit, the copyright privilege that was established actually as a deal struck by Sir Thomas Bodley with the Company of Stationers in 1609-10, and which today means that we acquire 1,500 new books every day, most of them for free, in return for our stewardship of that collection, that printed archive, on behalf of the whole nation. But actually, most of the materials that are consulted on a daily basis are not those great treasures, the manuscript high spots, but are electronic materials that we license or create ourselves on behalf of not just the academic community here in Oxford, but the whole international community of scholarship. And so our scientists and medics will generally be consuming the literature that the library collects and preserves in their offices, on their portable devices, in the wards of the hospital as they walk around. And from our electronic journal collections last year, there were about 8 million journal articles downloaded just by Oxford students and staff. And of course, the impact of Sir Thomas Bodley's great gift to the university and to the world of scholarship has felt its impact in many different ways. And the library has played a key role in bringing scholarship together with the collections that we've been accumulating. So Edmund Halley was able to publish one of the first great scientific works published by OUP in the early 18th century because the Bodleian had collected a manuscript of Apollonius of Perga, which my predecessor, John Hudson, the seventh librarian, transcribed for him as part of that kind of machine for learning. The great jurist, William Blackstone, was able to make the arduous journey from All Souls to the Bodleian in order to consult a newly acquired engrossment of Magna Carta, the 1217, which we'd just been given. It actually had been from the engrossment sent in 1217 to the County of Gloucestershire and had been kept in St. Peter's Abbey until the dissolution. And Blackstone was just writing his monograph on Magna Carta and was able to go and make last-minute changes which appeared in the publication. And that book, that description of the importance of Magna Carta as a legal and constitutional document, is found in the library of Thomas Jefferson a few decades later. William Morris came as an undergraduate into the Bodleian Library from Exeter College and had his first encounter there with medieval illuminated manuscripts from the European Middle Ages. And of course the Kelmscott Press was just one of the examples of his artistic and literary output that was inspired by that love of the Middle Ages. Began, we think, by the young man's encounter with the Nous Apocalypse and other great books in Bodley. We were one of the first libraries in the country, one of the first serious university research libraries to admit women. I think possibly actually the first one. There's very little evidence to dig into to verify this claim, but I haven't found any examples earlier than the Bodleian. This is actually Mrs. Humphrey Ward, a great, very, very popular novelist at the end of the Victorian period, and she gave this wonderful quote about one of my predecessors allowing her access to the rooms of the old Bodleian when there were very few women at that point admitted to any great library. But she relished the opportunity, and that's inspired her literary outputs. And she was also very much involved in the establishment of the women's colleges, in particular Somerville. C.T. Onions, one of the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary, wrote that the dictionary could not have happened without the Bodleian being next door. In fact, they had an office very close to the Bodleian to make it easy for them to access the resources of the library. J.R.R. Tolkien, as an undergraduate, wrote to his fiancée, later to be his wife Edith, that he'd just been admitted into readership of the Bodleian, a very daunting process, and he was absolutely terrified of the library staff, who made him feel sort of, on edge. But he said, "What riches I've been given access to." Dorothy Hodgkin, our Nobel Prize-winning scientist, the tutor of Margaret Thatcher, and one of the key individuals involved in the industrialisation of penicillin during the war, used our scientific journals very, very heavily. Oliver Sacks bunked off as a medical student to write his first literary work in the Radcliffe Camera. And Bruce Chatwin, although not an Oxford alum, but after his great journeys, came back and was given a readership of the library and sat and wrote many of his great books, like In Catalonia, In Patagonia and Utz, for example, in the Bod. One of my favourite examples is this. This is actually an illumination, an illustration from one of our manuscripts written by Matthew Paris, a famous medieval scribe. And of course, he gets Plato and Socrates round the wrong way. And this so amused the great cultural theorist Jacques Derrida, who was working in the Bodleian, and he passed by the library gift shop and saw a postcard there repeating and duplicating and multiplying this error, that he was so kind of taken by this that he wrote an entire book called La Carte Postale on this kind of cultural phenomenon, this cultural dichotomy. And even today, the set designer for the Doctor Who series lives in Oxford and regularly uses the Bodleian as part of his research. So the impact of the library is felt beyond merely the students and the staff who sit in the university and do their research and their studies, but has a much longer and more far-reaching impact. And we're actually a very busy research library. The usage of our collections, whether they're physical or electronic, is remarkable. And you can find that in across the disciplinary range, from the science library to the medical libraries, to our social science library, our business school library, and the hallowed portals of the old site like the Radcliffe Camera. And if you counted all the people who physically came into one of our library buildings in the year 2012, 2013, it would equate to the population of Greater Chicago. Many of those people are using books which are now stored outside of Oxford, actually, in our new high-tech storage facility just this side of Swindon, where we now have over 8 million books stored, and we deliver between 1,000 and 2,000 books every day back to the reading rooms, or there have articles scanned to your desktop. And that's a very busy place. But there are still several million books on open shelves in central Oxford, and some surprises as well, like this one in the Latin American Centre Library. And discoveries are still being made, even from the books which are have been here some time. This book actually wasn't one of our early collections. It was given to us by Victor Rothschild in 1979, largely because it has the inscription of Thomas Bodley, our founder, on the cover. And it's Boccaccio's Life of Dante, an important book. It's the first edition. And he thought, well, the Bodleian ought to have one of the books owned by Sir Thomas in his lifetime. Then a scholar at New College, Will Poole, just a few months ago, was looking at this quite carefully and noted the annotations. You can see that the book is annotated in the margin by an early reader. And he recognised the hand, and it's John Milton, possibly the greatest ever reader of Dante, reading Boccaccio's Life of the poet. And we're trying to share discoveries like this with as wide an audience as possible. The Polonsky Foundation has given us a donation to work collaboratively with the Vatican Library. So we have a big project now digitizing early books and manuscripts from the Vatican Library, which complement our own collections, Greek manuscripts, Hebrew manuscripts, and early printed books. And we're digitizing about 5,000 pages a week between us of these materials, and making them available online freely, like extraordinary treasures suitable for a building like this, the earliest surviving manuscript of Euclid, written in Byzantium by a scribe in the Imperial Academy in the year 888. We've done some work recently to look at where our scholars using the collections remotely, logging onto our website and downloading these materials, are coming from. And we did a heat map, and we discovered that it was actually easier to work out where they're not coming from. And you can see that we don't have many users from some of the Central African countries. That's something I hope that will be rectified over time. We don't have any users in Spitsbergen or the Falkland Islands or North Korea. Some of that electronic material we're now making available to you, our alumni, through clever licensing deals. And I don't know if any of you who've used our JSTOR access, which we provide for you, that's good to see some of you. Last year, there were 80,000 journal articles downloaded by Oxford alumni from JSTOR alone. So, and we're just about to add some more licensed resources to make freely available to you in the area of business studies and economics. So the Economist Intelligence Unit, resources like that, and also RefWorks, a reference management tool. But it's not all digital. The Vice-Chancellor has referred to the Dreaming Cranes of Oxford in before, and we had one of our own. Some wag dubbed it Bodzilla for a period of time. It's now gone, but there have been several new libraries opened just in the last few weeks. So last Monday, not this Monday of this week, but the Monday of the previous week, the Duke of Cambridge opened the Oxford's new China Centre, and on the basement floor is our new Chinese Studies Library, the KB Chen Bodleian China Centre Library, which is a wonderful new facility in the heart of that building. But on Monday we will open the first reading room of the Western Library, which has been a huge project to refurbish the building that many of you will know as the new BOD. The architectural historian Howard Colvin described it like a dinner jacket made of Harris tweed. Not the most beautiful building in possibly one of the most beautiful parts of any city in the country. But through a collaboration with the architect Jim Eyre, Wilkinson Eyre Architects, it's going to be completely renewed and refreshed. And it already, some of you will notice, the stone cleaning has given the building an incredible lift. And inside, it's going to look spectacular. There will be, next March, a new entrance opened up from Broad Street itself, and revealing views of the great buildings on the south side of Broad Street, like the Clarendon Building, the Sheldonian Theatre, the BOD behind, that really haven't been appreciated before. And we're also doing a great deal of very painstaking restoration of the physical structure of the building, replacing damaged stone with new, and some of the original Art Deco light fittings have been lost over time. We've made new facsimiles of those based on the architect's drawings and photographs. And we're bringing light into the centre of that building for the first time, and parts of it are going to be opened up to the general public as wonderful exhibition facilities. But most of the building, 60% of it, is actually underground, and that's going to be very new, state-of-the-art, climate-controlled, fire-protected storage for our great rare books and manuscript collections. Inside the building will be a big entrance hall, and off the hall will be exhibition galleries. Upstairs, very much a scholar zone with reading rooms. This is what it was looking like a few days ago. You can see the architect's impression. There aren't books on the shelves yet, but the original listed structure has been beautifully restored and lit and cleaned. And I must confess to indulging in a bit of French polish fetishing over some of the woodworking features. A new reading room for music, named by one of our donors after the late Sir Charles Mackerras, almost ready to go. And a new visiting scholars centre, new exhibition galleries I mentioned, an auditorium, nearly ready, and a new conservation laboratory, which very much bringing contemporary science into the art of the conservation and preservation of our historic collections, and collaborations with chemistry and physics in doing work to help understand the great cultural artifacts we have. A great deal of the cost of this building is going into improving our fire safety, and there was a tragic reminder of the importance of this work just a few months ago when the library in the Glasgow School of Art burned down for the lack of these sprinklers. Actually, these are fine misting heads which will control and prevent fire from engulfing the building like it did in Glasgow, completely reducing their library to a pile of ash. Very tragic. On the positive side, this, we are trying to deal with Sir Thomas Bodley's mission about sustainability in a variety of different ways, one of which is building a solar farm outside our book storage facility in Swindon. That's now linked up and powering the building. But one of Sir Thomas Bodley's other core missions was about building his collection. And I discovered a wonderful quote from the Oxonian A. Hausmann, the great famous pedant poet, who was reviewing a German scholar's new edition of Juvenal, and he discovered to his delight, a famous pedant, that the scholar had missed a variant reading which only survives in a manuscript in the Bodleian. And in this footnote, he said, the arsenals of Nemesis are to be found in the recesses of the Bodleian Library. And it made me think, how are we going to stock the arsenals of Nemesis today? Well, we do it by acquiring major archives. This is an example from the Oxfam archive, founded, of course, in this city at the end of World War II. Very important, huge archive. But it's not just bits of paper like that, it's electronic now. So Oxfam, still a major organisation, international reach. It communicates with the public electronically via its website. This is a copy of the website which they kept on CD, a very friable, ephemeral media itself. But also their business. They are communicating with their employees and their collaborators by email. They are keeping their finance records electronically. And we have to deal with that reality just as we have to deal with the reality of paper and print. We're also collecting other formats. The Bodleian has been a library of the text, famously, for centuries. But we also have fantastic image collections. And this is from the archive of William Henry Fox Talbot that we've just acquired. We try to make these resources and the research outputs of our academic community, as they're so prosaically called these days, the journal articles and the theses which are produced by our world-leading academics, through open access repositories. This is Oxford's, it's called ORA, the Oxford Research Archive, and it gets extraordinary use. In fact, the most heavily downloaded DPhil thesis, it was Rowan Williams's, which is downloaded about 1,000 times a month. And we've been taking some of our collections on the road to share them again with Sir Thomas Bodley's Republic of the Learned. So we've taken Magna Carta to places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. We took our great Persian collections to Melbourne a few years ago. And again, this is the Magna Carta engrossment that Blackstone used, which was at the alumni weekend in New York earlier this year. And our alumni were delighted to queue up and have their photo taken next to Magna Carta. And we recently launched a website of the first digitized our first folio, and Vanessa Redgrave came and helped us launch that. And we did a small exhibition in collaboration with the British Museum a few years ago in the European Parliament during the first of their Arab weeks. And I thought, well, we'll take these manuscripts which show the collaboration over centuries in science between the cultures of the Middle East and Europe. I thought we'd have a few, perhaps a few hundred people during the week would file by and see it, and we would have a few glasses of sherry to an assembled, quiet gathering. In fact, 2,000 people came to the opening, and it was opened by the President of the European Parliament with the Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament and the President of the League of Arab Nations, and just showing how the cultural and scientific riches of a library like the Bodleian can play a role in international diplomacy. We hope that you will come back to Oxford to see this exhibition, which will open the Western Library, our new building, in March next year. A selection of that show is currently in New York at the Morgan Library until the end of this month. It's been a great success there. And come back next year to see this extraordinary exhibition. But I'd just like to leave you with one of my favourite quotes from our founder, Sir Thomas Bodley, about his core missions, that issue about sustainability. And that's one of the tasks that faces me, is how to build our endowment back to the levels at which he established it back in 1602. Of course, we lent the endowment that he gave us, inverted commas, to Charles I to help him fight the Civil War, and we recorded it as a debt in our annual accounts until 1792. So that's one of my jobs. But at this point, I think we can move into conversation mode.
Thank you, Richard. What a fascinating presentation. Fellow readers, you'll see that we both come in character, Richard, dressed as the quiet, quietly efficient, smoothly omnicompetent librarian. I've come as a scruffy old don, the sort of person who uses the library. And as a scruffy old don, my memory stretches back to the days when libraries were books, and you sat in a library. And my first memories were of a different library, a library in Cambridge, Cambridge University Library, which I loved. I thought it was a wonderful building. It's a single vast space by the same architect as what we now have to call the Western Library, but hugely bigger, monumental, integrated. And in 1969 to 72, when I was an undergraduate, that seemed absolutely ideal. I came to Oxford 20 years ago to find something very different. Lovely historic centre, but things everywhere, and I found it very confusing, very difficult to use. Now, that was a result of two great universities making one opposite decision, wasn't it, at one stage?
And what? Yeah, that's back in, back in the 1930s. So I think it's been true of all of my 24 predecessors that they've been responsible for buildings which have failed to keep up with the incoming collections. And so, you know, the library opened to the readers in 1602, and we built our first extension in 1609. And then it's just been pretty much the same ever since. And back in the 1930s, there was an incredible crisis, because the legal deposit privilege, which had a steady trickle of books through the 19th century, suddenly began to grow and grow and grow, and there was no space in the central site. An underground bookstore underneath Radcliffe Square had been built in, finished in about 1908. That got full very, very fast. And in the 1930s, the university established a commission to say, well, will we do a Cambridge? Will we take a plot of land in the parks and build a whacking great library there? Or could we bear to part with the historic, with Duke Humphrey's Library, the old school's quadrangle on the central site? And the congregation of the university voted against the new site and said, no, we must keep our historic structures, the rag cam and the old board, and we must find another solution. And so Gilbert Scott decided it would be much better to pull down a row of Tudor houses at the end of Broad Street and to dig a big hole and to build the new Bodleian, and that's what they did. And that became our book storage facility, effectively. It joined up with the old library by an underground tunnel, which is still there, and a mechanical conveyor belt, which we used to, until relatively recently, have to employ a blacksmith to maintain, but one of the few libraries in the country to retain a blacksmith. That system really was designed literally to last 200 years, and by about 1976 that building was full too.
And it meant that I frankly warned research students about coming to Oxford that they might consider going to Cambridge because it was a more usable system. But now things are transformed, and I'm complete convert. I'm a penitent sinner now, because it seems to me that the library works superbly well, and that's simply because of the digitization that has happened in the last... Well, how long has it been, do you think, that digitization has been a significant factor in the libraries?
I think, the first thing we did was digitize our catalogue, and that really transformed access, because it meant you could see what we had online. You didn't need to come into the library and leaf through these enormous guard book catalogues or card catalogues. You could do that from your office or from home and plan your research much more efficiently. And then the colleges gradually joined up, fed their data into our catalogue, so that there was a single search and you could see at a glance where the books were in the different colleges. There are two that don't join in that system still today, but 36 others have. And that's a very powerful tool. And then we began to license electronic content from publishers in really beginning from the early 1990s. We were the first library in the UK to have a website. That was the mid-1990s, and the first library to do big-scale digitization, again, from the mid-1990s. So our ballad collection, our 16th and 17th century ballads, were digitized in about 1996, 35,000 ballads, and they're pretty much, that database is still a kind of set text for lots of other university social history courses, English literature courses, music, and bookmarked by students all around the world.
I think I first experienced between two big books. I wrote Reformation 2004, it came out. I then wrote Christianity, and between that, the experience of using the library had been transformed. And writing Christianity, I found it possible, having done lots of note-taking, and also lots of book review reading, to write my text in the morning, order books sitting with a cup of tea at home, have lunch in college, and then walk over to Bodley and look at the books, and alter my text from actually experiencing the books. This was a marvellous system, humanly marvellous, but it also worked very efficiently. And the one thing I found about it was that of the hundreds of books which I wanted to look at, and I really don't know how many books, but maybe 2,000, which went into the writing of that book, only 12 were not somewhere in Bodley. And I could sit at my desk and I say, oh yes, there's a copy at St. Anthony's in the Japanese Studies Library. I can go there. And as long as my trusty bike took me over the extent of the university, which made me healthy, I was finding it. That, I think, is the distinctive thing about Bodley. So many libraries have created good IT, but the fact that we have these physical collections of such distinction is something very precious. Mm. And that's what makes it so satisfying to be an academic here.
It is a big database, and it is very, sort of the technical architecture of it is complex, because we allow each of the colleges to set their own opening hours, their own due dates, their own fine levels, and give that granularity to each individual college so that they can manage their collection as indeed it is their own. But also, we have the Bodleian is a system of 27 libraries within the Bodleian system. So altogether there are I think there are now about 80 libraries which are covered by our single catalogue system. And that's a complex system which is only really replicated by some countries. So Denmark, Holland have national, and some of the other Scandinavian countries have national systems which are of a similar comparable complexity to ours, just in Oxford.
Do you have sort of summits?
We do have summits. There's been one this week, actually. So the software, all of the libraries that use the same basic software that we use have met in this building all during this week, called the International Group of Ex Libris Users, and there have been 400, mostly technical staff in the big libraries, meeting to exchange information, notes, doing some coding together in hack sessions, and trying to work collaboratively, as libraries do. They're really good at working together to make our services better.
I must confess now, I'm an off-site user most of the time. I'm a daily user of Bodley, but I never set foot in it. This summer, I've been working on a biography of Thomas Cromwell, and there is a wonderful archive now called State Papers Online, which is a commercial service. And so what Bodley have done is subscribe to it. I shudder to imagine what the subscription is.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's not inconsiderable. So we spend now more than half of our budget on electronic materials, and our book buying budget is about £7 million. So more than half of that goes on electronic materials, and the vast majority of that is actually spent in the areas of science and medicine. The humanities, the social science resources tend to be cheaper, but they and some of them, like State Papers Online, are actually a hybrid of a private-public sort of partnership. So the National Archives, who looks after the State Papers, collaborated with a commercial supplier to make a relatively affordable digitized resource of the State Papers, which we then go and negotiate hard with the publishers to make it affordable for us to have in Bodley.
I can't tell you how good this resource is. It is all the State Papers in the Public Record Office, now the National Archives, the British Library, from 1509 to 1714. All the great classes, arranged by the Victorian great calendars, catalogues of them, but behind each of those, click on manuscript, and it's there. So I sit at that same desk with that same cup of tea as before, but I'm going through manuscript by manuscript, thousand on thousand, 10,000 on 10,000, looking at what, when I was a little research student, I had to sit in an ill-heated room of the Public Record Office to use. And every morning when I switch my laptop on at 8 o'clock or 8:30, I give a little prayer to Bodley of thanks. Because otherwise, where would I be? And it has transformed historical research. And so I count myself as a daily Bodley reader, despite the fact that I think I've only darkened your doors perhaps once this summer. But it would not be possible without that subscription. Mm. I think it's liberating and extraordinary to be a scholar in this age. It's delightful and exciting.
But you're lucky because you have the experience of having handled the original materials. And one of the concerns that we have is that there are generations of graduate students who don't know what a manuscript actually feels like to use. And looking at an image, they're not really able to get the most out of interpreting the document. And the same is true of early printed texts, where those digitization projects sometimes miss pages, they skip pages, they skip the end leaves, and so they're not a replacement for the originals. They're a complement, and they massively speed up the process of research. But that's that sort of information literacy, as it's sometimes called, is a task that's now also being passed to library staff to ensure that our students, our graduate students, and even some of our senior academics are able to interpret and understand the material that they're now using.
One of the great things which I loved about Cambridge, which is still true, is that it is a social organism. And right from the start, Sir Giles Gilbert Scott built in a tea room with cheese scones of a similar monumental quality to the building itself, which you can still get. That's always been a problem in Bodley, hasn't it?
Yes.
That sense
yes.
of a social organism.
So that's one of the most frequently mention desiderata from our students when we do surveys, as they want somewhere to be able to have a cup of coffee, have a sandwich without having to leave the building. And we've put a sort of small common room in the old schools quadrangle. Some of our libraries, like the Social Science Library, are in buildings where there is a canteen that serves academic departments as well, which readers can use. But in the Western Library, there will be two cafes, tea rooms, one which we're going to call the Tea Room in homage to the UL in the Western Library. But there also will be a public, and that will be for staff and readers, and there will be a public cafe as well. So we very much pick up that. We try to learn from some of the criticisms we get and do something about it.
We've talked about the advantages of IT, but you've also hinted that there are drawbacks to the great IT revolution.
Yes, I think there was a great, my colleagues in the library profession made a great rush to embrace the digital, and that was exactly the right thing to do. But sometimes we forget the drawbacks, and some of that is about losing the physicality of the book. So the codex form, that's actually been a pretty successful piece of technology for 2,000 years. And there have been some recent studies showing how the cognitive benefits of paper reading, of codex reading, as against screen reading, actually Neuroscientists are beginning to tell us that you learn and retain information better when you're reading it like this, or when you're taking a note in longhand, than you do just simply by screen reading. And so that's one thing that, as a society, we need to take on board, and something I try to remind my teenage children, as they need to be surgically removed from their electronic devices. But also, there's the problem of the born digital material, the material that's never been physical. And that actually, for me, is a much more important concern, because, you know, we have the papers of seven prime ministers in Bodley, and the papers of contemporary politicians are mostly not physical. They're not actually on paper at all. They're email archives, they are websites. That's how they communicate with their constituents, with blogging and on websites. They draft their speeches using word processing software. They collect, you know, pictures using, you know, their camera phones. And how are we going to cope with collecting that information, which is the raw material for people like them in the future? It's actually really, really hard. And it's not something that an institution like Bodley can solve alone. It's something which a number of leading institutions around the world are grappling with at the moment. We've been doing a great deal of work in that space, but we've got a long way to go. And one of the things that we're doing is working with the other legal deposit libraries, the British Library, Cambridge, National Libraries of Scotland, Wales, and Trinity Dublin, to deal with electronic legal deposits. So the copyright material that is still coming to us in paper form, but is now also, under the legislation, coming to us in electronic form. And that includes the entire UK web domain. So we are doing collaboratively a crawl of the whole of the UK's web once a year, and that's terabytes of data. And actually preserving that material is a significant challenge. But that's just the UK's web. And of course, we have great collections to do with a country like, for example, Georgia. Now, Georgia is a political hotspot at the moment, and there's all sorts of people in Georgia blogging, using social media, putting up websites, and they're getting hacked, they're getting taken down by hostile action, they're changing all the time, and in order to capture that current historical data, we have to be nimble and fast and have the right technology, and then to keep the noughts and ones that underpin that information over long periods of time, when actually we only have relatively few decades of experience of how to do that.
So that does mean a librarian becomes someone very different, doesn't it, from the person in the Smirnoff advert, remember that? Now IT is where it's going to have to go.
IT is only part of it.
Yeah.
So the technical aspects of IT is part of it, but there's a huge range of other skills that are needed. One of them is legal. So intellectual property and copyright are issues which I spend a remarkable amount of time and my colleagues dealing with, advising other parts of the university, and building into contracts and those kinds of things. But also the kind of social and organisational issues around that. Actually contacting, you know, website creators to work with them, working with politicians. So one example is that librarians and archivists used to be, I'm afraid to use the term, ambulance chasers, or hearse chasers, in fact. We used to collect papers after a prominent person had passed on, and his or her family would, you know, kindly donate the archive of their loved one, who may have been a famous politician or an academic or a scientist, and we would deal with it ex post facto. But you can't do that so easily with digital information. So Barbara Castle left us 500 boxes of paper. But she also left us two Amstrad PCs of a very early variety. Now, she didn't leave the passwords for those, so we had to hack her Amstrads and extract the data off them, off all the boxes of those plastic, those plastic discs. You can't call them floppies because they weren't floppy. And so we've had staff going onto eBay buying old technology so that we can read some of the stuff that we find in even Edward Heath's archive. Had boxes and boxes of weird, outdated media that a form of digital archaeology is necessary to extract the information from.
Do you think we should open up discussion now?
That sounds like a very good idea.
So.
Brilliant.
Yeah, you just walked right up to him, and it was very easy to do, and I've actually sent the slides to be in the exhibition, I hope.
Oh, fantastic, great.
Now, the point I want to come to about this long introduction is that I rather imagine the old law, all the old law reports would have been digitized by LexisNexis and so on, ad infinitum, and I rather imagine that the rows of dusty volumes are really not needed anymore. So, do you have an empty library there?
We don't have an empty library at all. Some of those volumes are about to go to our book storage facility, so that we always have the print backup in case there are problems with the electronic service. And some of that space is actually being reused for people. So actually a couple of small departments in law are going to move into the library building. But there is, you know, a huge range of legal literature that is not online, and there's also a bit of a discrepancy between different parts of the world. So some countries have a publishing industry which is almost fully electronic, and some parts of the world don't. And you know, for example, in mainland Europe, their main trade publishing is very much still print based. And so the Taylor Institution Library is still acquiring lots and lots of print from European countries. And then some subjects are very electronic. Medicine is a very electronic discipline. Law, I would say, is a hybrid discipline. And English and history are becoming more digital, as Dermot was saying.
I wanted to ask you, sir, a few years ago I was asked if I wanted my DPhil thesis to be digitized. Now, I'm a dinosaur as far as all this is, but I felt that it would be nice for people who are on the digital wavelength to have it, and I gave my permission, but I never heard back.
Well, I'm sorry about that, but it will be online. You can go onto Aura.
But I'm not on the SSA, but I presume that, I was just wondering how well advanced you were with the
We've digitized about 3,000 Oxford DPhil theses.
Yeah, it was in 1972 minus.
Yes, and we've gone back. Back into the 1950s actually.
Yes, yes.
But not everyone has given us permission. We weren't able to track everyone down, so we haven't digitized anyone's thesis who didn't. Example. If it's not up already, it will go up in the next few months.
Yeah.
Yes. So like Rowan Williams, I gave the example of Rowan Williams, and his is at the moment the most popular of the early older theses that have been digitized.
It might not be because it's linguistic.
Well, you'll be surprised. You will be surprised. And actually, you can go on to Aura. So if you just Google Oxford Research Archive, you can actually see the number of times your DPhil has been downloaded.
Laid at the back, and then we'll go forward. Yeah.
Well, which particular aspect are you meaning the right of libraries to copy or individuals?
Individuals and disseminating papers and the
Well,
copyright materials.
That is still a kind of vexed question, and so I think I would say that there is still there are very different regimes of fair use between the United States and Europe. Europe tends to be much stricter about copyright. So the books we digitized with Google, we digitized about 200 million pages with Google of 19th century public domain material. And we agreed with our lawyers here in the university that we were safe to scan up to about 1890, and that there would be no literary estate still active that would be concerned of material before that date. And so we just scanned everything up to 1890 that was in a fit state to be scanned. Now in America, Google hosted that service and made everything available to Americans up to 1890. But to Europe, you were stopped seeing anything after 1863. Because they thought there was some remote chance that there would be someone who wrote a book when they were 7 years old and lived to be 112 or something, and that would be just waiting to sue Google. And so they took a very, very risk-averse attitude. Now, we kept copies of all of those scanned materials and have put them up on our website, on the search interface, the catalogue, called Solo. And so you can just download those books for free. And we allow you to do those. And so the licensing regimes, we use a Creative Commons license for most of the material that we put online, which allows free non-commercial use. And that's, I think, a regime that is a very good one, and that public institutions like ours are promoting, generally speaking. And that's certainly the same with the publications of our academic community, that we advise them sometimes on the use of copyright licensing if they want to put their material up on websites.
I do remember picking up a publisher who republished a book of my grandfather's from 1911. So it is quite a lively issue. Mm. Now there was a question, yes, gentleman there.
How big is the budget? Where does the money come from?
Okay, our budget's £40 million, and it comes from three sources. So about £12 million of that we raise ourselves, and that's from our endowment, from grants, from our income-generating activities, from philanthropic gifts, and the rest of our money comes from the university in two ways. One is from what is euphemistically called central adjustments. And central adjustments is really the funding that we are given by the university to support the kind of our long-term role in preservation and making our collections accessible to the whole Republic of the Learned, as we have been for 400 years. And then the other portion, so the 75% is roughly 40-60, and so the 60% of the 75% is comes from the academic divisions, effectively as a tax, and that funds the material, mostly the materials budget, so the material that we spend on buying subscriptions for Nature, Scientific American, and all the 20-odd thousand scientific and medical journals, as well as State Papers Online and those kinds of services.
And if you added anything to the other colleges,
yeah.
What proportion of your books and content there would be collective?
The collective collection
of the colleges as against yourself.
So our book stock, next year we will acquire our 12 millionth printed book. And we think the colleges have between them about another 2.5 million.
Mm-hmm. Lady there.
You mentioned in passing
Yes.
Alumni.
Yep.
Can you just say a little bit more about use of that for example, fairly recent journals. Could we sit at home elsewhere as a lab and get
At the moment, no. So JSTOR mostly has journal articles which are behind what they call a moving wall. So the most they have done deals with lots of journal publishers. I can't remember if the Journal of Ecclesiastical History is one of them.
Yeah, via CUP. It's a complicated one.
So, but they don't allow access to the most recent copies of those journals. But I think it's about 6 or 7 years back, they have the full back runs of around, I think it's about 2,000 journals. So it's a sizable corpus of material. And that's what you can use through JSTOR. And last year, as I said, there were about 70,000 downloads from Oxford alumni of that material.
Is it going to be possible soon to have more?
So we are, at the moment, negotiating as the license deals that we make with the publishers come up for renewal. Where we can and where we can afford to do it, because it costs money, we are trying to add in alumni access to the deals that we strike, which up until now have been purely for current staff and students. So that's a problem we have. We'd love to give you all access to that material. You can get access to material by getting your BOD card, which we'll give you for free, and coming into one of our libraries. We have 26 of them in the university. Or into any of the college libraries, and you will get walk-in access to all of that material. So come back and sit in one of our reading rooms and do your research. But for the material, so that's for the material that we can't give you access to. For JSTOR and for a whole, for about six now big business databases, you will be able to do those online through the alumni portal.
Gentleman there.
Digitize a document, how long does that last? Do we know how long the...
No, we don't. It's a problem. The problem is called digital preservation. And we know that it is expensive to maintain digital information. We know it's expensive to maintain digital information to maintain access to the information. So there's just storing the data and making it viable over long periods of time. That's hard enough. And, you know, we've got actually 50 or 60 years of the first digitized materials, that some of which have been kept going, some of them haven't. So there have been huge data losses that we have experience of, and then actually maintaining access to it. So maintaining it online is also a problem as operating systems change, web browsers change. There's a survey done recently as of the US Supreme Court judgments, and which have been online now for about 10 years. And about, I think it's something like a third of the links inside the US Supreme Court judgments online are broken. So they don't take you anywhere. So that's an example of the digital preservation problem. So maintaining that currency.
We have a small cultural foundation in Boston. We've been debating. We have some rather old Armenian language newspapers, and we're debating whether to go digital or whether, and we're microfilming because we've been told that the microfilm will last much longer than the digital, and I wondered whether you might comment on that.
I think that's a pretty good strategy, actually. I think that's a kind of belt and braces strategy. I would certainly digitize them and use... you can use various hosting services. You might even talk to JSTOR. They have a newspaper program themselves. Or the Library of Congress, which has a big newspaper program. But I would keep the microfilm and keep it safe and keep two copies. Keep the master microfilm copy somewhere different from the access copy.
We're on time, I'm afraid, so we must round up. But how exciting and satisfying to be Bodley's librarian.
You're so right.
I'm sure that it's also full of many travails and miseries, but we've heard all the good things today, and so that's a very good place to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you.